All right, welcome back to the deep dive. Today we're taking a look at, well, kind of a weird situation in the legal world.
Oh, yeah.
We've got two Georgia Supreme Court cases, both called Hines v. State.
Yeah, it's definitely one of those things that trips people up when they're, doing legal research, right? You see the same name, you think it's the same case. But
Right.
in this situation, it's actually two completely separate cases, totally different facts, totally different legal issues. So, yeah, that's why we're diving in today to, break it all down.
Yeah. So today, like you said, we're going to break down both of these Hines v. State cases, figure out what the main legal points are, and see what it all means for, how law is actually practiced and applied, especially down here in Georgia.
Exactly.
So let's start off with, I guess we'll call it the hunting accident case for clarity's sake.
Okay, sounds good.
So this first Hines v. State, as the name kind of gives away, it involves a hunting accident, really tragic situation. Robert Lee Hines is out turkey hunting with family and friends, and he had been drinking, before and during the hunt.
Yeah. And so it's getting late, the sun's going down, the hunting party decides to split up,
Right.
and Hines hears something moving around in the, the bushes, the woods, and thinks it must be a turkey.
Yeah. So he makes a pretty big mistake here.
Yeah.
He fires a shotgun into some really thick foliage. Can't see what's in there at all.
No, not a good idea. And unfortunately, this is where tragedy really strikes. The shot ends up hitting and killing Stephen Wood, who's about 80 feet away.
Yeah, really terrible. But even worse, after the shooting, instead of, calling for help, taking responsibility, there was a cover-up.
Right. Bad decisions just kind of keep piling up here, right?
Yeah. Hines tries to get other people in the group to, say that they were the one that shot the gun. And the group actually agrees to tell the police that they don't know who shot.
Wow. And to make matters even worse, he hides his hunting gear, including the shotgun, before the police even get there.
Yeah. But ultimately, the cover-up doesn't work. 2 days later, Hines confesses and leads police to where he hid everything.
Right. And they also found open beer cans, his beer cans near where the shooting happened.
Yeah. So, not looking good for Hines at this point. He's indicted on 2 counts of felony murder, among other charges.
Right. And this is where the case gets really interesting. I mean, it's obviously tragic all around, but the jury actually comes back with what's called a split verdict.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, they find him guilty of felony murder based on possessing a firearm as a convicted felon.
Okay.
But they acquit him of the felony murder charge based on the whole, misuse of a firearm while hunting thing.
So convicted on one, acquitted on the other. Doesn't make a whole lot of sense.
Yeah, that's what a lot of people think, but that's how juries can work sometimes. Anyway, Hines, obviously not happy with, at least one of those guilty verdicts, appeals the whole thing to the Georgia Supreme Court.
Right. So what are his main arguments to the court? What's he hoping to get overturned?
He makes three main arguments. First, he says there's not enough evidence to support the felony murder conviction at all. Second, he says the jury's verdict is just messed up, right? Like, how can they convict him of one type of felony murder and not the other based on the same facts? And third, he goes after the whole idea that having a firearm as a felon is even an inherently dangerous felony to begin with, which is necessary for that felony murder charge to stick.
Okay, well, that's a lot to unpack. So let's take it one argument at a time. First, not enough evidence. What did the Georgia Supreme Court say about that?
So the court looked at all the evidence, the fact that he's a felon with a gun, the drinking, the whole shooting blindly into the bushes thing, and they said, nope, there's enough there for a reasonable jury to convict him.
Okay, makes sense. Now, what about those seemingly contradictory verdicts? That feels like a big problem.
Well, here's the thing, and this is important for anyone studying law, especially in Georgia. Georgia does not have this thing called the rule against inconsistent verdicts. Juries are allowed to reach different conclusions on different charges, even if those conclusions seem to contradict each other. And there's actually a reason for this. It's all about the idea of compromise verdicts. Sometimes a jury might not totally agree on every detail, but they can still agree on a general outcome.
So maybe some jurors felt strongly about the misuse of a firearm while hunting charge, but not so much about the firearm possession as a felon charge.
Exactly. And that's how you can get a split verdict like that.
Okay, I'm starting to see how it all fits together. Now, what about that third argument, the whole inherently dangerous felony thing?
That's where it gets really legally tricky. The court basically said, look, being a felon with a gun can be an inherently dangerous felony, but it depends on the situation. You see, inherently dangerous doesn't just mean dangerous in itself. It also means creating a foreseeable risk of death based on the specific circumstances.
So it's not just about having the gun, it's about what you do with it. Or in this case, what you do while you have it.
Right. The court honed in on the fact that Hines was drinking, hunting in low visibility, and took a really unsafe shot without even knowing what he was aiming at. All those things, combined with the fact that he wasn't even supposed to have a gun, well, that created a huge risk of someone getting killed, even if he didn't mean to shoot anyone. And this is really important for our listeners to understand. The law doesn't just look at what happened. It looks at what a reasonable person should have known could happen based on their actions.
So Hines basically screwed himself by being reckless on top of breaking the law.
Pretty much. He also tried to argue that he made a mistake, thought he was shooting at a turkey. But the court said the jury was right to reject that because his mistake was his own fault. You know, he created the situation where that mistake was even possible by taking such a careless shot.
So to sum up the felony murder rule in this case, the illegal possession of the firearm directly led to the death, even if it was an accident.
Exactly. If he hadn't had the gun in the first place, none of this would have happened. So there's that clear connection between the underlying felony and the death, which is key for felony murder.
Makes sense. All right, so that was a lot in the first Hines v. State case, the hunting accident one. Now let's move on to the second one, completely different set of circumstances here. This one involves an armed robbery.
Right, completely different. So this time we have a different Hines, obviously, and he's convicted of armed robbery mainly because of a witness named Steve Henderson. Henderson testifies that Hines admitted to the robbery after they briefly left their car together.
So if I remember correctly, there wasn't any other evidence that directly placed Hines at the scene of the robbery, right?
You're absolutely right. The cashier at the store couldn't identify the robber because their face was covered the whole time. So Henderson's testimony is really all they have to tie Hines to the crime.
And this case also had some big procedural issues that came up during the trial, right?
Yeah, a few things happened. The defense tried to use something called a Brady motion, which is basically asking the prosecution to hand over any evidence that might help the defendant. They wanted to see the criminal records of all the state's witnesses, including Henderson, but the judge said no.
Interesting. So the defense couldn't even see if the main witness against their client had a criminal history. Seems like that could be important.
It definitely could be. And there's more. The judge also decided to block the defense from even mentioning that Henderson had been arrested for burglary during cross-examination.
Wait, hold on. So they couldn't use the guy's past arrest to question his credibility? That seems like it would tie into a potential motive to cooperate with the prosecution, maybe hoping for a lighter sentence on his own charge.
That's exactly what the defense was arguing. And to top it off, during closing arguments, the prosecutor made a comment about Henderson putting his life at risk by testifying. The defense immediately asked for a mistrial, saying that was totally inappropriate, but the judge denied that too.
Wow, so basically, the defense was blocked at every turn from trying to poke holes in the credibility of the star witness. And all this goes up to the Georgia Supreme Court.
Right. And they focus on two main legal issues. First, they have to figure out exactly what the prosecution's duty is under Brady v. Maryland, which is the big Supreme Court case about disclosing evidence. Do prosecutors have to actually go out and look for anything that might help the defendant, even if they don't know about it yet? Second, the court looks at whether preventing the defense from asking Henderson about the burglary charge violated Hines' right to confront his accuser, which is a big deal under the Sixth Amendment. That amendment basically guarantees a defendant the right to challenge witnesses in court.
Okay, so let's tackle Brady first. What did the Georgia Supreme Court decide about that whole evidence disclosure thing?
The court decided that Brady v. Maryland does not force prosecutors to actively search for evidence that might help the defendant. They said the prosecutor's job is to turn over evidence they already know about. That helps the defendant, and that's relevant to the case. But they don't have to go digging for new stuff. It's about not hiding things, not becoming an investigator for the defense.
So if the prosecution doesn't know about some piece of evidence, they're not in trouble.
That's what the court decided. Now, the Sixth Amendment and that whole confrontation thing, that's where it gets really interesting.
Okay, because the defense argued they had a constitutional right to bring up the burglary charge, right?
Yeah.
Show the jury that Henderson might be biased, maybe trying to get on the prosecution's good side.
Exactly. And you know what? The Georgia Supreme Court actually agreed with the defense, at least on principle. They said the Sixth Amendment absolutely gives defendants the right to cross-examine witnesses about potential biases, and that includes pending criminal charges. Why? Because those pending charges could be a reason for the witness to cooperate with the prosecution, even if there's no official deal.
Yeah, like even just the hope of getting a better deal. could influence their testimony.
Right. As Chief Justice Jordan pointed out in his dissent, and this is a powerful statement, a desire to cooperate may cloud perception.
So the court acknowledged that even subtle bias can be important. But did they actually say the trial judge was wrong to block that line of questioning in this specific case?
Well, this is where the law gets really nuanced. They agreed that the defense had the right to ask about potential bias, but they also said trial judges have a lot of power to control what questions are asked during cross-examination. They can stop questions that are redundant, harassing, or just not really relevant to the case. So in this case, while agreeing that the defense should have been able to explore potential bias, the majority didn't overturn what the trial judge did. They basically said it was within the judge's power to decide what's allowed and what's not.
So it's a balancing act. Protecting the defendant's rights, but also making sure the trial stays focused.
Exactly. And here's another layer. There were actually dissenting opinions on this point. Some justices said they wanted a broader right to cross-examine witnesses. They thought that even the possibility of a witness wanting to please the prosecution should be something the defense can bring up. They wanted to make sure defendants can really challenge the credibility of witnesses, even if the bias isn't super obvious or stated outright.
So even if there's no explicit deal, the idea that a witness might be hoping for favorable treatment is something the defense should be able to bring up.
Right. And some justices felt strongly about this. They thought the majority opinion was too restrictive and didn't do enough to protect the defendant's right to a fair trial. They argued that the defense should have been able to really dig into the witness's motivations, not just accept what they say at face value.
Wow. So there's real disagreement within the court on how far you can go in questioning a witness's motives.
Definitely. It's a complex issue with no easy answers.
All right, so we've covered a lot of ground here. Two very different Hines v. State cases. Let's try to sum up what we've learned, especially for our law student listeners.
Sounds good. When you compare the two, some clear differences pop up. The Hunting case focused on all the details of felony murder. How do juries decide if something is an inherently dangerous felony? What specific facts matter? And the big takeaway there is that your actions while committing a crime can make that crime way more serious if those actions create a foreseeable danger to others. Even if you didn't intend for the bad outcome, the risk you create is what matters.
Right, like speeding in a school zone. Even if you don't hit anyone, it's still reckless and dangerous.
Exactly. Now, the armed robbery case dealt with completely different legal issues. It was all about the balance between the prosecutor's duty to disclose helpful evidence under Brady and the defendant's right to confront their accuser under the Sixth Amendment. And that right to confront means being able to question the credibility of witnesses and expose any potential biases they might have.
And we saw that even the possibility of bias, even if there's no concrete proof, can be enough to cast doubt on a witness's testimony.
Right. So for law students, these cases offer some real-world lessons. First, when dealing with felony murder, there's no simple answer to whether a felony is inherently dangerous. It all comes down to the facts of the case, the specific circumstances surrounding the crime, and the foreseeable risks created by the defendant's actions.
And second, Brady and the Sixth Amendment highlight this constant tension in our legal system. We want prosecutors to be fair and turn over evidence, but we also need trials to be efficient. And at the same time, we have to make sure defendants can challenge the witnesses against them, even when those biases might be subtle or unspoken. It's not always about cut and dry deals. Sometimes it's about the hope for a better outcome that can sway a witness's testimony.
Right. These cases show how important it is to really analyze the facts in felony murder cases and to think strategically about how to challenge witness testimony in any criminal trial. It's about digging beneath the surface and understanding the nuances.
Well said. These two Hines v. State cases have given us a lot to think about, really highlighting the complexities of criminal law here in Georgia.
They definitely illustrate how our legal system tries to balance competing interests and uphold fairness for everyone involved.
Absolutely. And on that note, we'll leave you with a final question to ponder. We've seen how the law deals with felony murder and the rights of the accused. So what does all this mean for how our criminal justice system works? How might these cases impact future defendants here in Georgia? It's a question worth considering as we continue to grapple with these complex issues.
It definitely is.
Thanks for joining us today on The Deep Dive. We'll see you next time.